Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Today, we will be reading the following articles: Transition to Operations, and From Chicago to Champaign. The first article is Transition to Operations, Adding an Operating Scheme to the Cascade Division, by Scott Kramer, photos by Craig Wilson. I fell in love with the Great Northern Railway when I was very young. It started with a Varney F3 and GN's simplified scheme. Before long, I settled on the Cascade Division as the basis for my model railroad, specifically the portion from Skokomish to Wenatchee. Much time has passed since that early interest, but it just got more intense. I started building my layout in 1982 with the purpose of recreating a rail fan layout that would make me feel like I was there. Living in Michigan meant seldom having the opportunity to travel to Washington to see the real thing. That layout, the history, and construction were featured in Model Railroader's February 2008 issue. However, life goes on and changes all the time, and luck can even be involved. First, I was asked to join a Friday night round-robin group, the Midnight Pocatello Yardmasters. They're a group of superb modelers that helped me become a better modeler. Perhaps more importantly, they operated their layouts, something that was new to me, but was fun. Operating schemes were somewhat varied. Most were, quote, Mother May I dispatching. Many of the model railroads featured direct current control, which made for interesting, if somewhat restrictive, sessions. Communication included a loud voice or small radios. Car forwarding was by computer-generated switch lists or, in at least one case, four-cycle car cards. I began to look at other layouts and how they operated, as well as the prototype railroads. What an eye-opener. The operating process used by real railroads varies drastically by time period, location, size, operational density, and tradition. Then came the big question, what do I want to do? I remembered the golden rule of model railroading, quote, it's my model railroad, end quote. I visited a lot of layouts. I tried layouts that were a series of switching puzzles. I visited model railroads that would move 2,000 cars in a session. I visited layouts that were big and small and watched how that affected their operational choices. During this period, I began to modify my layout and develop the additional things needed, like a means of communication, staging, a car forwarding system, and a dispatching system. Then came a chance to learn from three people who had what I wanted. Now, before I go any further, I want to emphasize that what I want to talk about is for me. In total, it may not be what suits you. But the one thing I hope you will think about after you have read this article is, quote, do I want to be a model railroader, end quote. By that I mean, is it important to you to have a layout that not only looks and feels like the prototype, but is also run like the real thing? The first two people I learned from were Doug Tagsold and the late Jack Ozanik. Both run full timetable and train order, or TTNTO, systems. Both also have single-track model railroads with long runs. My layout is a single-track mountain railroad with a 500-foot mainline. My six towns are all 60 to 90 feet apart. Doug and Jack's layouts keep a crew as large as 14 busy for hours, but only move 10 to 16 trains. That few trains in a session that lasts anywhere from 4 to 8 hours might seem slow to some, but it's not. Both layouts included sufficient switching opportunities. But not all trains do switching, which would cause some modelers to dismiss TT and TO offhand. However, it isn't unusual for some operators to just enjoy running a train, and TT and TO still requires that you keep your mind on the schedule and your orders. The last piece of the puzzle came from Tony Thompson. He has a blog, modelingthesp.blogspot.com, that's very informative. I was inspired by Tony's series of posts about waybills, which are up to 115 at last count. If you're willing to put in the effort, Tony will teach you how to develop a car forwarding system that is very much like the prototype. Waybills are an essential part of running your layout like a, quote, real railroad. In addition, I learned about TIBS, or T-I-B-S, a method to identify your towns, their industries, and spotting locations. It works perfectly with waybills. In the end, I found another piece of the puzzle I was looking for. Having done the necessary research and finding how things work, I then modified my layout. The first item was an expansion that eliminated tight spots and opened the whole layout, improving visibility and operator access. Next came a dispatcher's office and an agent operator desk. Seth Newman helped me install a 1950s push-to-talk phone system with a phone at each station, a speaker and microphone for the dispatcher, and a beautiful antique candlestick phone on a scissor mount with headset for the agent. That took care of communication. I installed train order board mimics at each station controlled by the agent. I also added two tracks to my staging area. Finally, a fast clock that normally runs at 2-to-1 ratio was installed. Once the physical changes were made, I addressed the paperwork. I know you don't want to deal with paperwork. Well, neither do I really, but to me, it's worth it to feel that I'm working a real railroad. I developed a timetable and had it printed. It's much more than just a schedule. It has the rules and information necessary to run the trains, with much taken right from a 1955 Great Northern timetable. Did you know you were supposed to stop and inspect a train that has loads of long poles or pipes before going through a tunnel or a through bridge? Well, maybe that's carrying it too far, but it's what the real railroad did. There are forms for the dispatcher to use, including train sheets, train orders, and clearance forms. There are also books for the dispatcher and agent to use to record their communications. I was lucky again as my friend, Rich Remyars, had made computer-based copies of all the forms used by the Great Northern and was kind enough to share them. So, how does this all work? An operating session on my layout can last 6 hours or more. That's half a day at 2-to-1. We use a dispatcher, an agent operator, someone to work staging, 2 yardmasters, 2 crews for locals, and 3 for road crews. That comes to 10 people, a few more if we use any 2-man crews. Note that the road crews do not do any switching, as I found out the hard way. While I was at Jack's, I set out 3 cars, and he informed me never to do it again, as I had just cost the railroad $200 for working out of my assignment. One of the good parts of my operating session is the variety of assignments. Running a passenger train is very easy. All you have to do is keep at the speed limit, follow the schedule, and OS, or report passing, at each station. If you are going in the superior direction and are a first-class train, you don't even have to worry about another train. Other assignments are more complicated. In the end, I found what I wanted. By my experience, I know it's not for everyone. I like it, though, because it makes me feel as if I'm in the Cascade Mountains in October 1955 at the seat of a Great Northern Railway Electromotive Division FT set with a string of cars behind me. I need to have read and signed the rulebook, and remember, I have to keep my mind on the job because I'm in the middle of the mountains and there's no one to tell me what to do. It's my responsibility. Meet Scott Kramer. Scott is retired from his career as the Director of Generation Procurement with Detroit Edison. He purchased more than 8,000 prototype rail cars during his time there. Scott and his wife, Kitty, love to travel and have visited more than 40 countries. They have two grown children who have always had an interest in Dad's model railroad. The next article is From Chicago to Champaign. This 25 by 40 foot HO scale layout depicts the Illinois Central Gulf in October 1976. By Brian Lingner. Photos by the author. My interest in model railroading started when I was around 8 years old and living in Chicago. At Christmas time, a neighbor filled his entire living room with Lionel trains for everyone to enjoy. Later, as a teenager living in a southern suburb, I ran trains on a friend's layout. We also visited a model railroad that filled an entire bedroom, reminding me of the trains I enjoyed in my youth. After going through the usual hobby hiatus, school, marriage, career, my interest in model railroading was renewed years later during a business trip to Denver. I stopped at Caboose Hobbies and purchased a Silver Streak mechanical reefer kit. I was hooked. Soon, I built a 6x10-foot layout with flex track and turnouts. I later moved to a northwest Chicago suburb where I constructed a model railroad on a 4x8-foot sheet of plywood. This is where I first attempted scenery. In the late 1970s, I attended a National Model Railroad Association, or NMRA, regional convention and visited an open house. The layout owner asked if I'd like to do some switching. Of course, I replied, yes. He showed me to a town where he had an Electromotive Division GP30 waiting and many industries to switch. The owner said he would check in on me later. 2 hours later, he came back to rescue me. I'd finished the work and thanked him for the opportunity. Later, after I was included in his operating group, he taught me how to hand lay track and custom build switches. This was also my introduction to model railroad operations. Daily inspiration. So, what led me to model the Illinois Central Gulf, a product of the August 10, 1972 merger between Illinois Central, IC, and Gulf Mobile and Ohio? When I was living in the south suburbs, I took the IC commuter train to Chicago each day. This gave me a front row seat to activity along the entire route to the Windy City. Those memories would prove useful later, as my intent was, and still is, to be as prototypical as possible. Once my wife, Sharon, and I were settled in our new home in the northwest suburbs, I concentrated on designing a model railroad. We had family members that lived in the south suburbs, and each visit required a somewhat lengthy stop at Markham Yard to capture the action. To determine how much of the ICG I could recreate, I took our travel trailer on week-long trips to follow and document the railroad. I also spoke with as many industry personnel in the towns I was interested in modeling as I could. Most were happy to oblige, and some even gave me the routing to both their inbound and outbound products. The second time around. Armed with all this data, I converted the finished basement family room by adding wallboard to the upper half of the paneling, painting it blue, spraying clouds using stencils, and rearranging the drop ceiling lighting. I then built my first version of the ICG. Unfortunately, it had too many negatives, including duck unders and direction reversals. I tore it down and began work on the model railroad shown here. The current layout is a point-to-loop design from Chicago to Champaign, Illinois, ICG's 100-mile crew district. The track plan follows a 1973 ICG condensed profile with some modeler's license, such as changing double track areas to single track with passing sidings. The north end of the layout represents Chicago. The 10 staging tracks are all stub ended. The south end is Champaign and all points south. The 13 staging tracks there are a loop in the crawl space. Trains start at Central Station, MP0, and run past Donnelly & Sons to Harvey, MP20. From there, they pass Markham Yard and are visible until Auto Tower, MP60, before entering Champaign Station. Benchwork and track. I constructed the layout using open grid benchwork with risers supporting the 3/4-inch plywood sub roadbed. I topped the plywood with 1/2-inch homosote. All visible track and some instaging is hand-laid code 83. I built all of the turnouts in place. I turned to code 100 flex track and turnouts for the hidden staging yards. I added power feeders to each 3-foot section of rail. Most turnouts are operated via a toggle switch that controls a slow-motion Hankscraft display motor. Others use Caboose Industries manual ground throws. The first operating session on the layout was a nightmare due to lack of staging tracks. I resolved the issue by giving 2 members some liquid refreshment and having them go into the crawl space to raise champagne staging 6 inches. Then Kankakee was removed, a middle level was built for improved Chicago staging, and the tracks from Mantino to the crawl space were raised accordingly. The final change was the addition of more staging tracks at Champaign. Successful scenery. To model changes in elevation, I made a web of cardboard strips covered with window screen and Durabond 45 joint compound. For smaller land contours, I applied the drywall mud directly to the layout and shaped it to the desired look. After the compound set, I painted these and all flat surfaces dirt brown. Before applying Woodland Scenic's fine and coarse turf, I spread a thin layer of white glue. After the scenery material was in place, I sprayed it with wet water, parentheses, water with a teaspoon of isopropyl alcohol added, end parentheses, to break the surface tension. I secured the ground cover with a 50-50 mix of water and white glue, parentheses, with a teaspoon of isopropyl alcohol added, close parentheses, applied with a Nalgene LDPE unitary wash bottle. For later scenes, I used a Nock Grassmaster to apply various shades of static grass. Bridges and buildings. The most challenging scene was the Kankakee River Bridge, which I built and scenicked at the workbench. The structure is made up of 30 3D printed parts, graciously produced by a member of our operating group. Once assembled, I painted it and set it aside. I modeled the Kankakee River in 2 sections. The front section, on which the bridge is placed, is permanent and has a spillover on the backdrop side. The back section is removable to gain access to the tracks underneath. I made both river bottom sections from 1/2-inch press board. After painting the material, I added walls and embankments. Then I sealed the edges and poured the river with Envirotex epoxy resin. Once the resin cured, I added waves with Mod Podge. Finally, I set both river sections in place and attached the bridge to the front section with canopy glue. Wanting to follow the prototype as much as possible limited the number of usable off-the-shelf building kits. As a result, about 80% of the structures are scratch-built, using pictures and field measurements as guides. Due to space limitations, some buildings had to be selectively compressed. I included some industries not found on the prototype to increase operations. Fellow modelers contributed 3 scratch-built structures. Most of the downtown buildings in Piatone are reworked design preservation model kits. The remaining structures are from William K. Walters Incorporated, the majority heavily kit-bashed. Diesels and rolling stock. My locomotive fleet has a mix of first and second generation diesels. America's bicentennial year saw a colorful mix of units on the full-size ICG, and my fleet reflects that. I have diesels in IC's green diamond and orange and white schemes, as well as GM&O's diesels. Approximately 70% of the units are custom painted and decaled. Except for one local with a single engine, most trains feature 2 or 3 diesels. The lead engine is always sound equipped. In 3 unit consists, the 3rd unit is unpowered and unlit, placed between 2 powered units. Paired units always remain together. As such, they don't have reverse headlights. Each consist also uses the same digital command control, or DCC, address for ease of programming. Most of the rolling stock is typical of the era. About 30% of the cars are custom built, painted, and decaled based on prototype photos. Plenty of kit-bashed and customized hazmat tank cars move across the railroad, testing the yardmaster for proper train placement. Running trains. I use a Lens DCC walk-around system to control trains. The layout is operated using handwritten track warrants. We follow a 3-to-1 fast clock, resulting in 3 8-hour sessions. A typical operating crew consists of a dispatcher, 2 yardmasters, 2 local crews, and 4 road crews. Each operating session sees around 20 trains, consisting of 2 locals and a mix of freight, passenger, coal, and trailer-on-flat car traffic. A 1973 ICG freight manifest provided the train names and times. I used modeler's license to include some prime IC passenger service from late 1967. Markham Yard is the originating and terminating point for all freight and interchange traffic. Live interchanges from Chicago Staging to Markham Yard include the Belt Railway of Chicago, Grand Trunk Western, Indiana Harbor Belt, and Soo Line. West Line Staging sends trains from Hawthorne Yard, Glen Yard, and Council Bluffs, Iowa. All road freight makes at least 1 set out and pick up en route. During the AM session, an ICG local runs from Markham Yard to Richton Yard. Once there, making 3 separate moves, it works Richton, Governor's Gateway Park, and Monee, then returns. During the midday session, a second ICG local originates in Kankakee Yard and works all trailing point sightings in Indian Oaks and Manteno. The train leaves cars for facing point sightings on the storage track at Indian Oaks before proceeding to Piatone. Normally, the work there is finished at the end of the session. At the beginning of the PM session, the second ICG local heads back, working Manteno's other siding and the remaining spurs in Indian Oaks before returning to Kankakee. The Kankakee yardmaster usually has several cars to weigh using a Boulder Creek engineering weigh station. Each session also has industry-specific switch jobs. In addition to ICG, I also run trains from the Elgin, Juliet, and Eastern, or EJ&E, at Madison, Illinois. 2 locals are run, one from Juliet staging in the AM session and the other from Gary staging during the PM sessions. The EJ&E doesn't run during the midday session. The EJ&E locals serve online customers and deliver interchange cars to the ICG at Richton Yard. ICG road trains deliver cars to the J's Madison Yard. During the AM session, the EJ&E returns empty coal cars to the ICG via the same interchange. Loaded coal cars are received from the ICG during the PM session. Fun with friends. I'm happy that model railroading is my hobby, as there are so many ways to find satisfaction. Most days I spend some, or a good amount, of time working on projects. There are still buildings to finish and rolling stock to kitbash. Almost every Friday night, I'm at a member's model railroad for an operating session. In addition to running trains, I enjoy the post-session camaraderie when we have pie and coffee. Other daytime sessions are enjoyed as well. I'd like to thank all of those I've encountered over the years for their help, sharing the hobby, and hosting and participating in operating sessions. My satisfaction recreating the prototype comes when someone compliments a scene, building, or equipment that they recognize. Meet Brian Ligner. Brian Ligner of Cary, Illinois, retired after 41 years in the Bell system. He has been married to wife Sharon for 60 years. The couple enjoys spending time with family, attending musical presentations, dinner with friends, and riding an occasional dinner train. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.